This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In his recent State of the Union address, President Obama pledged a new moonshot in the race to find a cure for cancer, led by Vice President Biden at Mission Control. This, of course, was a tip of the hat to President Kennedy's challenge to use the country's resources to put a man on the moon within 10 years. We were in competition then with the Soviet Union, the space race, and it's a race we won. That race required money and determination, but at its heart was science. Those same ingredients would be required for this new challenge, but in fact, this isn't a new challenge. In 1971, President Nixon signed the National Cancer Act, declaring a war on cancer and promising a cure within 7 years. So the question becomes, can this be done? Some have posed other questions, like, should this be done? Even, is this a good idea? We're going to turn to some of the people on the front lines of cancer research in our region for some answers here. Dr. Derek Raghavan, MD, is an internationally known cancer researcher, medical oncologist, and president of Carolina's Healthcare Systems Levine Cancer Institute. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Good to see you again.
Dr. Adam Kuykendall is a specialist in gastrointestinal cancer and cancers of the genital and urinary organs. In other words, a medical oncologist with Novant Health Cancer Specialists. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And Dr. Pinku Mukherjee is the Irwin Belk Endowed Distinguished Professor of Cancer Research at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for coming back. Nice to have you here again.
Thank you.
Get a little closer to that microphone, if you would. So, when the president made his State of the Union address, if you were watching maybe the day after when you heard about it, what were your first thoughts when he declared this cancer moonshot? Dr. Raghavan, I'll begin with you.
Well, I had two thoughts. One, I was delighted that the president was focusing on cancer and suggesting that there might be more money for cancer research. I have to say I'm a bit of a lip reader, and I was struck by the fact that the vice president, as they focused in on him when they mentioned his involvement, leaned over to Paul Ryan and said, "I knew nothing about this." And that made me a little uneasy in terms of how much planning there'd been for the whole shebang.
It was put in that afternoon, probably. Dr. Mukherjee.
Yes, I was listening very closely because my whole life depends on money from the federal government to do research. So it was extremely exciting that that was mentioned. And I'm hoping that, you know, with NCI being pumped in much more money than previous years, that researchers like us will really be able to do some real translational and clinical work.
NCI being the National Cancer Institute.
National Cancer Institute.
Dr. Kuykendall.
I had a very similar reaction to my colleagues. I mean, you're always excited to hear the field in which you work mentioned and known that it's going to be a priority. And also knowing that over the last, 5 years or so, the NCI has had a pretty flat budget. They haven't been increasing research investment and things. And so to start to commit to that and to grow the pot of money to be able to perform some of this research was very encouraging news.
It's interesting to compare this effort, I guess, to the moonshot, because as I said at the beginning, they both have scientific aspects to them. But the moonshot was rocket science. And this is not rocket science. Rocket science, I think, might be easier. It's an engineering project with math rules and the rules of physics. You're dealing with biology and human cells. Are these comparable in any way scientifically?
I can take a crack. No, it's not. You mean engineering, tweaking this math formula and tweaking the human cells is not really the same because you never know what's going to happen. You can have a great algorithm and you still don't know. But what's exciting about this project is that they are able to get the genome and then try and understand the immune system. That's my passion, and come back after many years to shine. And so they are going to really focus on the immune system that shapes your cancer, makes your cancer grow, and can actually deplete your cancer. So as I said in my previous talks, that immunotherapy or vaccine or something to do with our host immune system is the only thing that works most of the time.
The only thing we know about so far that works most. The war on cancer that President Nixon launched in 1971, has there been an outcome to that? Or are we still in that same war? I mean, was progress made incrementally? Did we see anything out of the funding that was put into the research on cancer because of that then or now? Has it paid off in any way?
Yes, I think you would have to say it has paid off. Now, it's a slow progress. Often the, you know, football field analogy is made, and I think that's a fair one, though it's a 1,000-yard field and you're moving a foot at the time. But every year there is progress. Every year we're seeing breakthroughs, and some of them are minor. Some of them are a bigger deal. But we're curing more people. We're prolonging people's life longer. We're doing things to fight this terrible disease, and I think that's of a tremendous value. We've got a long way to go, but we have made progress since the 70s, undoubtedly.
Now, this can't go ahead, Dr. Rocco.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the problem is that when you start beating a drum and set targets for a war to be finished, and we see that, in fact, in politics generally in the world today, you set yourself up for disappointment. And so when President Nixon declared war in 71, it was due to be finished about 20 years ago. Then Andy von Eschenbach, who was the director of the National Cancer Institute, declared war again that was due to be won by 2015. We just missed that. So when you set a date, I think you set false expectations. And one of the big problems today is, as you know, Michael, healthcare is becoming incredibly expensive. We're in a situation now where when you declare war, you have to win it, and so you end up expending resources that you might not expend if you were doing it in a less dramatic fashion.
So would it be better to do – could you get the same kind of influx of cash or whatever is needed, excitement, getting young doctors involved in cancer research – without this kind of focus?
I think having a focus, as Adam said a minute ago, is a very good idea. The key is not to set a target that's an artificial one that creates marching bands that are marching to no particular direction. So I think if you simply identify that cancer is a huge problem to the community, it kills people, it's expensive, it keeps people out of the workforce, and simply say, this is a battle that we have to fight again and again and set realistic expectations, then it allows people like the three of us to do our jobs, have the funding to do it, but not have false targets that often lead to disappointment.
Is that why, Dr. Kuykendall, you said that of this moonshot, cancer moonshot announcement, that this is a quite ambitious effort, is quite ambitious, which is a quote, by the way, is that a code for impossible?
I don't know that I would go that far to say it's impossible. I think we'd all like to dream one day this is going to be something that is mostly a disease that we have under control. But I think it is, as Dr. Roghaven was getting into, it's setting a date or realistically expecting this to be a battle that is going to be won at some specific date in the future, or that it's one battle. It's a battle against a multitude of different diseases that are all labeled cancer but behave differently, even within the same type of cancer, behave radically differently.
To use the war analogy, is this more like conventional warfare, or is it more like the fight against terrorism, where you're playing whack-a-mole?
Nobody wanted to pick that one up, yeah. Michael. cute question. Right. So I'll take a crack at it. So it's somewhere in the middle. The reality is that we've been using conventional warfare techniques since the 1970s. I guess you could call chemotherapy that. You know, it's sort of like carpet bombing. Now, as Dr. Mukherjee mentioned, we've got the genomic revolution, and we're starting to actually build a very rational science base to that. Pinku and my group are collaborating right now, exploring and exploiting antibodies that she's developed that actually target specific pieces of particular cancers. We've got at Levine Cancer Institute a collaboration with a national molecular diagnostic company where recently we've looked at more than 5,000 cases and looked at gene expression versus outcome. So we're becoming much more focused. Superb scientists like Pinku, who, you know, UNC Charlotte recruited from the Mayo Clinic. So, you know, we're starting to build a presence in Charlotte. They're doing work that is really pretty unique. And so the focused approach to cancer research is going to allow us to make great progress. But as Adam said, you know, this is a lot of different diseases under one rubric.
Right. As Politico, according to Politico, which is a political rag. According to Politico, the White House is developing a detailed roadmap for accelerating research, compressing 10 years' worth of work into 5 using the NIH and private partnerships. What have you heard about this?
Yes, so what I've heard is that this Dr. Patrick Sonshong has created this coalition of people, and he's doing it really, really wonderfully, where he is actually, before you even start doing anything, he has people from the insurance company, from the banks, from, you know, people backing this up with the money, because that's what happens. As Dr. Raghavan said, it's expensive. There's only 2% of actual cancer patients who even go for clinical trial. 2%. Where are we falling? I mean, where are we failing them? So there are clinical trials that only 2% can go for or even know about. So it's concentrated on in certain cancer centers. And so, you know, it's very difficult for normal people to get into those clinical trials, so there aren't enough of them.
So is that one way to compress 10 years into 5 by enrolling more people in clinical trials so you can get more speedy access to data?
Yes, I think that's their goal. They're going to do 100,000 patient genome, you know, the whole genome thing, and they're going to have 20,000 patients in clinical trial within this 5 years. So the knowledge that we'll get, I don't agree, or I find it very ambitious also that we will, you know, cure cancer by 20, whatever their date is, 2020. But we will learn a lot more and a lot faster.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think that's a really good point that a lot of people don't understand about trials is that it's a moment in time where a patient is eligible and sort of the stars align that there is a drug available, there is something that we can study, and that moment passes if the trial is not there when that patient needs it. And like at Novant, we've been working to get this trial called the NCI Match Trial, which is a really excellent idea where they are taking those genetic studies that we've been talking about and pairing up drugs with different genetic mutations for patients. And this trial has been on hold nationally because they're analyzing data. They don't have enough money necessarily to get as many patients screened as they need. So they're trying to sort through these logistic challenges. And meantime, patients who could be benefiting from that testing and possible treatment are not able to do this, and therefore, while they want to do the trial, it's just not there for them at the moment they need it.
Why? Is it simply money? Is it insurance companies not wanting to pay for it? Is it lack of access to doctors and hospitals? What's going on?
I think
there?
It's organization. Oh. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think the reality is it actually already is there. We at the Levine are one of 4 centers nationally that are part of an American Society of Clinical Oncology matching trial that's already open. We've got, as I mentioned, a collaboration where we've looked at 5,000 sequences of gene expression and have matched them to the outcomes of chemotherapy. And I think the big mistake that's been made traditionally, and I think it's changing now, is, as Dr. Mukherjee said, a lot of the cancer research has been based in ivory towers that are in major centers where the population base just isn't there. Even, you know, where, think of, say, New York City, just getting to these places can be a real challenge.
We'll talk more about clinical trials. And that's one of the things that you mentioned as being very important. The lack of access right now is holding not only cures and better outcomes for patients back, it's holding research back. We'll get back to that when we come back from the break. How confident are you that a cure for cancer can be found? Share your thoughts on Facebook or Charlotte Talks on Twitter. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Yanni and his orchestra performing a selection of songs spanning his career and newly reworked arrangements this Sunday at Belk Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. Tomorrow on this program, it's the weekly regional news roundup, and folks in Raleigh have been busy this week drawing maps. Oh, my. That will be what we talk about for a good part of the program. The legislature redrawing the maps because of a court order, and the results are surprising to say the least. We'll talk about what it may mean for you if this turns out to be the final map. The Democrats have yet to put in their own suggestions on this. CMPD has revealed that African Americans are being arrested more frequently for possession of marijuana. We'll have more on pupil reassignment and the South Carolina primary all tomorrow. at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, millennials in the 2016 race will make up the same percentage of the voting population as baby boomers. This makes them a crucial demographic for Republicans and Democratic candidates. What will get them to the polls and what they want from the next president?
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cancer and the president's moonshot cancer challenge that he mentioned in the State of the Union address. He put Vice President Biden in charge of this in terms of increasing the amount of money that will be going to cancer research and compressing the time frame from 10 to 5 years in the hopes that we can find a cure in that time, which, as I've gathered from around the table, that's probably not possible, but it's a good thing to shoot for, I suppose. Dr. Derek Raghavan is with us. These are all doctors, so let me just put that out there right now. Derek Raghavan is here, researcher and president of the Levine Cancer Institute. Adam Kuykendall, a gastrointestinal genitourinary specialist with Novant Health Cancer Specialist, and Pinku Mukherjee, who's the Irwin Belk Professor of Cancer Research at UNC Charlotte, on social media and on email. We'd like to hear your thoughts about how confident you are there can be a cure for cancer in the near future. Let's go back to clinical trials, because I know that you have called, all three of you have called for greater access to clinical trials, and you have said, Dr. Raghavan, that patients on clinical trials have better outcomes than those who do not participate. That actually surprised me, because in a clinical trial, you may be on the placebo, right?
Not necessarily. You know, I think there are a number of factors that make that a true statement. Firstly, there will be some case selection. What that means is more robust patients, people who are looking for trials, people who are taking their own healthcare into their hands will often offer themselves up for clinical trials. There's no question that the level of support from cancer centers for patients on trials is very thorough. Not to say that patients off trials aren't well supported, but there is an additional layer of support because you're working at the level of the unknown. And in the past, many of the patients who got into trials were in urban centers, and so they were selected again in terms of the resources they had locally. One of the models that we've developed over the last 5 years is to move away from our central headquarters. So we now have 25 outreach centers. We've set up clinical trial mechanisms at all of those. We have the ability to actually take biopsies and study them at a molecular level. And so we believe that we will be able to change the level of accrual to trials by this model of bringing trials to patients.
Is the other part of the problem, if you come down with something as serious as cancer, the immediate thought is find the best doctor and the best hospital you can find, and the thinking in America has been, well, those hospitals must be in New York, Chicago, the Mayo Clinic. You don't think of necessarily Charlotte or Nashville or even Atlanta in some cases for certain cancers. Is that incorrect thinking? Do we need to readjust our thinking as lay people?
I think it's outdated thinking.
It's outdated. We have to think of the other centers doing much, much more for the people because of the demographics, because of who can access that healthcare system. I think
we're fortunate here in Charlotte. We've got, two large healthcare systems. We have a number of hospitals and cancer centers and some excellent world-class doctors here. So I think while there's a place for big cities and patients to travel there sometimes, but I think the vast majority, and certainly with what we do with the drug therapy, the same drug that is FDA approved in Texas is FDA approved in North Carolina. The clinical trials are different, and we have trials that are not available in Texas or in New York, as they have trials that are sometimes not available here. And trying to expand that network and making sure every patient has access to appropriate clinical trials is important.
And just as digital technology has revolutionized communications and other fields of endeavor, I'm sure it's revolutionizing your.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm, yeah. So, one of the things in my group, we've recruited more than 150 cancer specialists to the Levine, to our different sites. And they've come from the MD Anderson, from Cleveland Clinic, where I used to work, from Johns Hopkins. people are moving away from the centers to get to where the patients are so they can help people where they live. We connect all of our centers by video technology. We have case presentations that run across our system. We can review pathology specimens digitally. So a patient, say, in Whiteville, North Carolina, can get his case presented with a tumor board of 50 people who are specialists and a pathology panel who will be looking at the specimen and have access to getting involved in a trial and getting new treatment. So that's really a huge sea change in the last few years.
And I think we also shouldn't – it's not just about the physician. I mean, I think these tumor boards, which are available at both centers, are excellent, but we, you know – have nurses that go out and help navigate the patients through the system, go out to the patient's home. We've had them meet them at different places. So it's not just about the physicians. It's also about the support staff and having that resources within, in our case, within Novant, to go out and do those things to help patients through what is a very complex and difficult journey, as all of us can imagine.
But I want to point out one thing. The Charlotte misses, what it misses is educational medicine, which is there is no medical school.
Yeah.
And so the only university here is UNC Charlotte. And, you know, we have to be able to work with these big health organizations to really make something out of this. I mean, this moonshot thing, if you actually look, it's academicians, it's small companies, small biotechs, it's big pharma, it's insurance company, it's big health centers. They've all come together. We have to do the same in Charlotte. We have to. We can't just say we don't have a medical school, so we can't do it.
So
imagination is what should drive us.
I'd have to disagree a little, Pinku. I mean, I think there's a lot already in place here. I mean, your group and ours collaborate. UNC Chapel Hill has 50 of its medical students being trained at the Carolinas Medical Center campus. At Levine, we have a hematology-oncology training program that's been approved to train 9 fellows. We've got research scientists doing a lot of very sophisticated work. We have epidemiologists looking at the causes of cancer. We've supported your lab in many domains. So, you know, I think the essential pieces are here.
So what I'm hearing you saying, though, Dr. Mukherjee, is that because we don't have a medical school where communication happens within among doctors and students,
yes,
and hospital settings and clinicians and,
yes,
patients, that we're working in silos. And that's one of the things that Vice President Biden said about all of this. He said, right now, the science, data, and research results are trapped in silos, preventing faster progress and greater reach to patients.
I agree. I totally agree with what Biden has to say. I think this will open up some of those communications and hopefully have more transparency.
How will it open them up, and why haven't they been open before?
No,
if you see the need and you're in the business, why haven't people just said, okay, we're in silos, let's get rid of them?
Well, I totally agree with Dr. Raghavan that, you know, after Dr. Raghavan came, things are moving in the right direction. It needs to move faster. It needs to have that ability for a scientist and a clinical scientist to meet all the time, talk, and you know, do things together. There has to be small biotechs that get involved in this type of research. I mean, that's where innovation and things happen, you know, by talking, by sharing data, by sharing samples, by, you know, that kind of
stuff. This comes from your experience at the Mayo Clinic, doesn't it?
Yes.
Is what you're missing?
I miss that.
Yeah.
I definitely miss that. And I'm still hoping. I've been here 7 years now. I'm still hoping that that'll happen, that, you know, we'll be able to do things that way because we had separate organizations. Everybody has their own way of working.
And you've also said that most researchers work on one cancer or another, which leads to their being pigeonholed into focusing on one type of cancer rather than taking a broader approach. Would a specialist such as yourself be interested in other fields?
No, I didn't mean it that way. I didn't mean they were pigeonholed with one cancer at all. What I was meaning is that when you look at epithelial cancers, they're all deriving from the epithelium, there are some commonalities in that cancer, and we have to look at that, look at the differences and the commonalities. Is what I was getting at.
Dr. Kuykendall.
And I do think, I mean, one thing we need to be careful about, though, is that we're not just building another silo here in Charlotte.
Yeah.
It's not. We're not trying to build, nor should we build, in my opinion, an academic medical center that's like Duke or UNC or lots of centers around the country. That's the model that's been there. We need to all work together, get patients across Charlotte, across the country, and these trials, these testing, and that's easier said than done, absolutely.
It's got to be very difficult, because we have representatives from two different hospital systems. Both of you run advertising to attract patients to your hospitals for whatever reason you want to attract them. Obviously, the bottom line is the bottom line here. And part of the silo problem the vice president lamented was the fact that you also have like one or two drug companies sometimes working on a particular drug for a particular cancer. And they don't want to share, because whoever comes out first with the right drug at the right time is going to profit from that. Same is true, would seem to me, of hospital systems. How do you put the profit motive aside and throw open the doors to researchers to share information, to share even patient outcomes?
You know, I think the vice president isn't fully up to date.
You know,
I think the reality is that the pharmaceutical industry has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. One example is Roche Diagnostics, and Roche Therapeutics has set up an initiative to share genome data with different companies. Sanofi Aventis has created a data sharing mechanism where they actually pool information with many different drug companies. In the world of molecular diagnostics, at the Levine Cancer Institute, we're part of a National Centers of Excellence program where we actually meet regularly and share data with Fox Chase Cancer Center, the Karmanos Cancer Institute in Detroit, and two or three other centers scattered throughout the USA. And for the last 50 years, there have been cooperative research groups. Adam and I both have been members of the Alliance Cancer Research Group. I've been in the Southwest Oncology Group. There's a radiation treatment oncology group. There are surgical collaborative groups. So the myth that this is all siloed is a grand political statement. There's no question there's competition, and competition is healthy, but there's a tremendous amount of interactive research that goes on all the time. And even here in Charlotte, Bob Wilhelm, who you know is one of the vice chancellors at UNC Charlotte, and I co-sponsor some of Pinku's research, and there's another superb researcher, a nanotechnologist called Susan Trammell, who's been working in the field of figuring out how to identify the boundaries of tumors when surgeons operate on them. And she and my surgical team are working regularly. So this idea that there are really entrenched silos was true, but it isn't so much true now. There's a lot more interactive research going on.
What's your take on that at Novant?
I think that is some true. I definitely think the system is opening up. I think we participate in national trials and work with these large cooperative groups. And I think on the local level, I have had a patient come to me from Levine for a trial opportunity, and patients have gone the other way as well. I think it's both the doctor's responsibility to do what's best for the patient. Look out for if they are interested in a trial or they know of a trial that would be good for that patient, then I think you try and provide that opportunity, whether it's with your center or another center somewhere else.
I mean, competition is a good thing because it spurs you to try to find cures and treatments, better treatments more quickly. But on the other hand, it would seem to me you'd want the credit for it. That's just human nature, isn't it? So when you're asked to throw open the doors and share information and do all that good stuff of breaking down the silos, does it go against your natural inclination to do so? Or is it more in a scientist's interest to break down the silos?
I think it's in everybody's interest to break down the silos. You know, I've been publishing collaborative research for 30 years. I've got studies that I've published recently that I've initiated on an international basis when I was Dr. Kuykendall's age. So this is not new, Mike. It's been going for a long time. And people do share credit. There are nice rules of play. The person who is the intellectual driver is probably the person who gets the most credit. But someone like Pinku might lead a team that would have someone like me involved in publication if I've supported her work and we've worked together. So it's really not rocket science to figure out how to share.
Well, speaking of rocket science, this is called the Cancer Moonshot, and the president says for this moonshot he wants to spend $1 billion in the search for a cure, $195 million in new funding to the National Institutes of Health this year, and then $755 million in research for fiscal year 2017. How far does $1 billion take you in the field of cancer research?
Me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've already spent over $20 billion. So if you
since
look
in what time frame?
In probably what, 10, 20 years.
So this is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
But is it a drop in the bucket for 5 years? Because they want to shorten the time frame
yeah.
to five years.
So that's the difference. So that is the difference.
Where should the money go? I know there are significant breakthroughs being made in your field of research, which is immunotherapy for cancer treatment. Where should the money go? Where are the most promising fields that seem to be on the tipping point or a verge point where a little more money, a little more help might really make a breakthrough?
So right now, immunotherapy is a very hot area. And to her great credit, Pinko has been singing the praises of immunotherapy for a decade. And so good for you, Pinko. And it's really important. Exploring the genome, tremendously important. We are forgetting something where government has really let us down quite badly, and it would be negligent if I didn't introduce it into our conversation. So there are two major issues. One is disparities of care. So poor people, the less wealthy African Americans, the Hispanics, particularly those who haven't learned English, are not getting the same cancer care as people who are wealthy and have insurance and who are white. The second area is that some domains of the pharmaceutical industry have been completely irresponsible in failing to provide life-saving anti-cancer drugs that are known to work, and the supplies of these drugs just dry up unexpectedly. And Adam's group and mine are constantly challenged with there suddenly not being a supply of
drugs.
Let's
start there. Why is that?
Hard to know. The companies claim that it has to do with government regulation. My own view is that it has to do with the amount of money they make from selling drugs. If there's a drug that doesn't give them that much, then they focus their attention somewhere else.
Well, you're making my case for me.
Yeah.
What's the profit motive is what it is. And if you want to open all these silos and share information, they're still at the end of the day – this need to make money, and a lot of it if you're a drug company.
So we're talking a little, Mike, at cross purposes. So what I'm saying is the scientific community is working well together.
Yes.
And some pharmaceutical companies are sharing information. They may not necessarily be the ones who are providing some of the drugs that we need. Mm. And the way to deal with this is for the government to get tough. Clearly, money changes hands inside the Beltway, and they've left the companies alone. The president promised years ago to fix the problem, and it isn't fixed.
Will a promising drug for cancer treatment always get the funding from pharmaceutical companies that it needs? Or if it's not, would there be other drugs that they would see as better for them and their bottom line in 10 seconds or less?
So... you mean...
Well, I'll come back to it.
Yeah.
We'll come back to it.
It's a big question.
It's a big question. We'll get a big answer when we come back, and we'll share with you some of the comments that have been coming in on Facebook, Twitter, and email as we've been talking here. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and AC Entertainment, presenting Bill Maher Friday, August 19th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available tomorrow at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com. Millennials in the 2016 race will make up the same percentage of the voting population as baby boomers, and this makes them a crucial demographic for Republican and Democratic candidates. What will get them to the polls, and what do they want from the next president? The topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. You can email us at charlottetalks at wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Elio Masferrer Khan says the Pope's visit has given progressive elements in Mexico's church the opportunity to speak out.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The CMS meeting was packed. Applause for speakers indicated how divided the room was.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cancer and the cancer moonshot that the president announced in his State of the Union message in January with Dr. Derek Raghavan with Levine Cancer Institute, Dr. Adam Kuykendall with Novant Health Cancer Specialists, and Dr. Pinku Mukherjee, who is a professor of cancer research at UNC Charlotte. So the question I ask that requires a big answer is, if at the end of the day the profit motive is what controls things, particularly in the area of pharmaceuticals, is it possible that a pharmaceutical company would, even if they have a promising drug in the pipeline or a drug that has literally shown that it can do significantly good things for a cancer patient, if there's another drug that can bring in more money, are they likely to keep pushing the other drug that brings in less, even though it's more beneficial?
I think that companies are driven by the profit motive. I think we see again and again that some companies will push one particular drug where they have unique licensing versus another useful drug. I think the reality is that it's expensive to develop these drugs, and the companies, to stay viable, need to have a mechanism of staying financially afloat. They just do it extremely efficiently and well.
If Novant comes up with the cure for cancer in general or a particular kind of cancer, that would be an incredible feather in your cap. Same thing holds true for Levine Cancer Institute and any other hospital system or research system in the country. Are you likely to put that in jeopardy by sharing all this information? And are you likely to steer people to different things when you are really convinced that your path is the right path?
It's a question of whether you're convinced that your path is the right path. I think the truth is that hospitals and their physicians and scientists share data, information, and they publish their data every day that ends in a Y. So let's say, hypothetically, that the Levine Cancer Institute hits a home run in leukemia, which I think is likely to happen in the near future. It doesn't mean we'll cure all leukemias, but we've got some very exciting research. We'd be idiots not to share it with people like Adam Kuykendall. We want our patients to have the benefit, and Adam would accept it. We will claim the credit for being the first, and they will confirm our data, and we would work jointly to do that. And that's honestly, Mike, that happens all the time. People like to have the bragging rights to be the first there. But the way to get that invention known and useful is that you share it with other people once you've shown that it works. And that's the way collaborative research groups work all the time.
Yes. And the steps, though, to go from nothing to active drug are many and fraught with paths that are going to lead to nowhere. And so it's rarely is it one institution or one entity pursuing this from start to finish. It's they use the published research. They use the things that are out there that someone else discovered. They do collaborate. They do, you know, work that's under federal grants and then becomes drug company partnerships. So it's a complex process, and rarely is there one inventor that you can say that's the person. There is oftentimes someone who deserves a large portion of credit for pushing it, but it's often a very collaborative process.
You know, if you think about melanoma, so President Carter has this excellent situation where he has apparently gone into remission with a number of the new drugs that treat melanoma. You know, that is the product of the work of thousands of people who've collaborated. And if I asked Pinku or Adam, so who's the person that fixed this? They would give me 10 different answers, because there have been a number of people in the science field and in the clinical field who've teamed up. Here in Charlotte, there's a physician at Novant and a physician at Levine, both of whom have been active in developing clinical immunotherapeutics and phase one trials. Move up the road to Raleigh-Durham, same story applies. So these major steps come from having money to do the research, well-trained people who work in cooperative and collaborative groups and share information as quickly as they can.
money is obviously required because it takes people, it takes equipment, it takes time to develop these treatments and cures and just to do the research to see even if there could be a treatment or a cure. And immunotherapy is probably a good example of that. How much of it has to do with money? And how much of it has to simply do with the brilliance of the researchers and the doctors administering all of this and just the luck of the draw? You hit upon something that, by golly, you didn't think it was going to be there, but there it is, and it's going to work. How much of it is money? How much of it is that?
Well, this immunotherapy is not about money. Immunotherapy was there for a long, long time. It started in 1800s, where they were giving you a bacteria to cure cancer. I mean, that started a long, long, long time ago to rev up your immune system to fight cancer. And everybody knew that the immune system actually fights every day you have a mutation in your cell, and that cell is killed off by your NK cells, which are called natural killer cells in your body. So you don't even see that you have cancer. So that those mechanisms are already in place in our body. So it's nothing new. What's happened now is because of the advances in our molecular methods and our scientific research methods, people have been able to target it. So now they can say, okay, now I can take the cell from your body, re-engineer it so that it goes and fights your tumor. This is what they're doing.
But my question is, did you get there because you had the money to get there or because you had really good researchers
both.
Who also had some luck on
both.
Their
side?
So it's
of
both.
Of course,
Mike.
Both. You need a lot of money to do this type of research.
If you don't have the support to do the trials or to do the investigation, a great idea will just sit there without evolving.
And I think an important point to get back to something you had asked earlier is, how should we direct our funds?
Mm-hmm.
And some of this, if it's a top-down approach, doesn't necessarily work. 5-10 years ago, immunotherapy, except for some dedicated believers, was not something that was really on the radar. It was not the hot new thing.
Correct.
It was a field that people knew existed, but not a lot had come from it so far. There had been some discoveries. But now it is the field. It is the interesting thing. So we have to be open to what's going on now, but also preparing for what might be the next field 5, 10, 20 years from now.
You just said something interesting. The last two times you've spoken, you've said something not unlike what you just said, where you said not a lot had come from it until recently. And you talked earlier about any kind of research. You go down pathways that sometimes have dead ends. They don't lead anywhere, but you don't know that while you're going down the pathway. So when you put a time frame on a war on cancer and you say, we're going to cure this thing in 5 years or 10 years, even if the president gets the $1 billion from Congress, and it's a Republican Congress, and who knows what will happen in an election year, but even if he gets it, is there a danger that if you don't cure cancer in 5 years or 10 years, the well will dry up faster than perhaps it would have in the absence of the war, because Congress will say, well, we gave you all this money, where's the cure?
So that's exactly the point that I opened with. I think when you set false targets, you create a situation where people are likely to be disappointed. If you simply say, we're putting money into a war and we're going to identify where there's progress and celebrate the victories, then you're not constantly disappointing people. So that was my concern when they set a finite time. The thing that bothers me about Patrick Soon-Shiong's work, apart from the fact that he has a for-profit corporation that will benefit from an injection of funds.
And he's the fellow that was on 60 Minutes.
Correct.
Okay.
The thing that bothers me is he set an artificial target. There'll be a huge inpouring of funding. He, I guess, stands to benefit from that financially. And then if he moves on, it leaves the rest of us standing there saying, okay, so where did this target come from? Mm. That's what happened twice before. And those of us who've been at this for a long time and those who've come into it more recently, we're here all the time doing this work every day with or without the funding that we seek. To create an artificial target is going to create disappointment. Focusing on the need for finances and an organized expenditure of finances will allow us to do our work. But as I said a minute ago, we also need to make sure that everybody has access to the same care.
Mm-hmm.
if everybody in the USA had access to the care of a wealthy Caucasian, we could halve the death rate from cancer instantly.
I want to go to some listener comments and questions, but let's follow up on that because you've brought that up twice, that African Americans and Hispanics who don't speak English, those without insurance, et cetera, do not have the access to these clinical trials and the cancer treatment and care that affluent people have. Why not? We have private insurance. We have the Affordable Care Act. Why not?
Well, they do in some domains. So at Levine Cancer Institute, we treat everyone. Doesn't matter whether they can pay us or not. But there are many parts of the United States where that doesn't apply. There's a phenomenon that we call cherry picking. And so some of the best-known hospitals in America will only treat insured patients. So they're skimming. They're taking the patients who are the wealthiest and most robust. If you are in the real world and treat everybody that comes through, then you can make the impact that you wish to. And so we've done that at Levine. But at a national level, there are people who simply cannot get into some of the best centers because they can't afford to do it. And that, I think, is a disgrace. When we start beating our chest and talking about the war on cancer, this is a political imperative. And as you know, Michael, our state legislature rejected the Affordable Care Act. We do not, or have not in the past, had federal funding coming in here. So the taxes you and I pay go to other states to support their indigent patients. I believe that's going to change. But the reality is there is not even, Stephen, approaches to health care for the indigent in this country.
So I totally agree with all of that. But there is a fundamental problem, too, that we are not putting in enough money to do research on disparities. So now NCI has realized that, and they are putting in money to actually study the differences of the cancer from an African-American person and a Caucasian and a Hispanic or an Asian even. So there are differences there too. So when you talk about genomics, it's not just the genomics of the cancer, it's also the genomic of the whole human.
And I think the other part to all this is, and you know, Novant provides the same opportunities of access, is not just access to the medical oncologist. It's the access to the primary care. It's access to stop smoking. It's doing the preventative things that is can make huge difference in the number of people who are coming down with this illness.
You know, the Governor McCrory, and Republican legislators have said the reason, one of the reasons, aside from opposition to the president's health care plan in particular, the reason that they did not get on board with this in open state exchanges is that to do so, they would have had to expand the Medicaid program, and they would have had to take federal money. It was going to be free for the first 5 or 10 years to the state, but at some point, the state would have to take it over. And they said the system is broken now. They can't afford it the way it is. And so why would they take on more debt 10 years down the road? That's why they didn't do it. But if you, both these hospital systems and other systems in the state are taking in these indigent patients and giving them this expensive care, who's paying for it?
You know, the payment comes from a lot of places. I can't speak to whether Novant does this work or not, but I can tell you that Carolina's healthcare system in 2014 gave up $1 billion of charity care. We lost on our Medicaid contracts, our Medicare contracts, and $500 million
where does that money come from?
Indigent. Well, it comes from a lot of places. You know, I think that
Does it come from taxpayers?
To some extent, yes. It'll come from donations. If you say that donations come from taxpayers, a lot of our indigent work is philanthropically driven from foundations. So, for example, the Duke Foundation has supported some of our educational programs for indigent African Americans. We currently have a $2 million grant pending with a foundation for doing lung cancer screening.
Is the same true of Novant?
Yes. There's a large portion of charity care that is given out every year, but it's compensated through some of the tax base, some federal incentives, some money from other areas. There is well-known phenomenon of private insurance winds up supplementing to some degree the less contracts you're going to make money on. But it also, again, goes back to this, we're going to pay for it anyway. Mm-hmm. Somehow, some way. And so if a patient isn't seeking care until they're much more advanced, That's a problem. If they can get in the system earlier, it's cheaper.
Let me go quickly to some listener comments. Chris on Twitter, is getting cancer under control, as the Novant guest said, the same thing as curing it? And let me add to that, is curing cancer too simplistic? Because it isn't just one disease. Would it be okay to make it a manageable,
chronic disease.
Chronic disease.
Yeah.
We all believe that.
Yeah. And we have done that. That's been, in my career, the biggest change, that we've changed cancer from something that killed people within weeks to months to something that can be controlled by a mix of chemotherapy and immune treatment and various other approaches, so that the one of the targets is to stop people dying and stop people suffering the side effects of either treatment or the cancer itself.
And is really a cure the end goal for most of the people involved in the process? So Bill emails, I'm trying really hard not to be cynical about curing cancers, but what is the incentive when so much money is being made by so many entities under the guise of treating cancers and promoting cures?
I think the reality is with any illness, people will make money from having curative treatments. You know, if we as a community were more sensible, I mean, people still smoke, they go out in the sun too much, they eat too much. You know, as a community, unfortunately, the members of our population will continue to present themselves as victims of cancers because of some of their habits. And so the medical profession, the hospital profession, and the pharmaceutical profession will be here to try to pick that up. So, you know, I think the truth is if we can cure people, we do better than if we can't.
And Christian emails, we have maybe 20 seconds for this. What do you think the impact on the Affordable Care Act is relative to cancer treatment? Has it helped?
I think it's helped in some states.
But not anything here that improves access is good.
That, you get the last word. That's Dr. Adam Kuykendall, who's a gastrointestinal genitourinary specialist with Novant Health Cancer Specialist. Dr. Derek Raghavan, researcher and president with the Levine Cancer Institute. And Dr. Pinko Mukherjee, the Irwin Bell Professor of Cancer Research at UNC Charlotte. Very quickly, are you optimistic that this cancer moonshot will have impact? Yes or no? Doctor?
Yes.
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 We'll leave it there. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte?